Chapter 14. Turn this dark, maddening charge, all you I once knew snagged like moths in the still web of younger days. Rise up from the fresh white foam in the face of my seaward plunge. Howl against my wild run and these wild blazing eyes. But I hear the call of how life once had been, and such heat in the crushed chirr of locusts rubbing the high grasses of a child's road. And the summer was unending. The days refused to close, and I played savage and warrior, the heroic nail upon which worlds pitched and wobbled, blue as newborn iron. And these salt winds were yet to blow and sink corrosive teeth into my stolid spine and my stiffened ribs, that could take the golden weight of a thousand destinies. Where are you now, my unlined faces, on those rich, sighing summers, when we gods ruled feral the wilding world? Hollow husks turning on threads of tired silk, so lost in my wake. And you that run with me in the blind stampede, this charge we cannot turn, and the sea awaiting us waits with its promise of dissolution, the fraying of youthful days, the broken nails, the sagging ribs, the summers drifting away and away, and forever away. Broken Nails Lament, Fisher. Someone was screaming in agony, but that was a sound War Leader Gaul had grown used to. Eyes stinging in the drifting smoke, he swung his horse round on the dirt track and unleashed a stream of curses. At least three raids were swarming out from the village in the valley, lances held high, grisly trophies bobbing and weaving.
"Coltane, take those fools and crush them under his heel! Gerab, ride down to that commander! He's to form up his troop and resume scouting to the south. No more attacks. Tell the fool I'll have his loot, his wives and his daughters, all of it, if he disobeys me again."
Gerab was squinting.
"That is Shalamassa, war leader."
"Fine. Her husband and her sons. I'll take them as slaves and then sell them to a Dras. Balt's broken nose, she needs better control of her warriors."
"They're just following her lead," Gerab said. "She's worse than a rabid she-wolf."
"Stop chewing my ear," Gaul said,
wanting to pull a foot out of the stirrup and drive it into the man's chest. Too familiar of late, too smug, too many hood-damned words and too many knowing looks. After Shalamassa was dealt with, he'd send the pup yelping and turn a blind eye to all the wounded looks sure to follow. Gerab tried a smile, which faltered as Gaul's scowl deepened. A moment later, the young Tyr runner kicked his horse into motion and rode hard for the shouting, yipping raids. Above the sickly smears of smoke, the sky was cloudless, a canopy of saturated blue and a baleful sun that seemed to boil in the sky. Flocks of long-tailed birds swooped and cut in erratic patterns, too terrified to land as Cundril warriors swarmed the ground in all directions. Fat, finger-long locusts crawled through the ruined fields. The advance scout troop was returning from up the road, and Gaul was pleased to see their disciplined, collected canter, lances shod and upright. Which officer was that one? Making out the leather-wound hoop dangling from the man's weapon, he knew who it was. Vedith, who had crushed a town garrison early on in the campaign. Heavy losses to his raid, but then hardly surprising. Young, in that stupid, foolhardy way, but worth taking note of, since he clearly had firm command of his warriors. A gesture, while they were still some distance away, halted all the riders behind Vedith, who then rode up to Gaul and reined in.
"War leader! A Balkando army awaits us, 2 leagues distant, 10,000, 2 full legions, with a supply camp crawling with 3 times that number. Every stand of trees within a league of them has been cut down. I'd wager they've been in place for 3 or 4 days.
Stupid Balkando! What value fielding an army that crawls like a Bedouin with its legs cut off? We could dance round it and strike straight for the capital. I could drag that king off his throne and plant myself in it sloppy as a drunk, and that would be that. he snorted. "Generals and commanders understand nothing. They think a battle answers everything, like fists in an alley. Coltane knew better. War is the means, not the end. The goal is not to wage slaughter. It is to achieve domination in the bargaining that follows."
Another scout was riding down from the north, her horse's hoofs kicking up clods of dirt from the trampled plow furrows, hairs scattered from her path as she cut through the trampled crops. Gaul squinted at her for a moment, and then shifted round in his saddle to glare southward. Yes, there, another rider, in foaming gallop, shouting as he wove through Shalamassa's whooping mob. The war leader grunted. Vedith had taken note of both riders.
"We are flanked," he said. "What of it?"
Gaul asked, eyes narrowing once more on this young, clever warrior. The man shrugged.
"Even should a fourth element march up our backsides, war leader, we can slip through the gaps. They're all on foot, after all. Like a slink between the claws of a hawk. But nothing here can even hope to pluck our tail. Vedith, I give you command of 1,000. Yes, 50 raids. Take the North Army. They'll be on the march, dog-tired and choking on dust, likely in column. Give them no time. Sweep and cut, leave them in disarray, and then ride on to their baggage train. Take everything you can carry and burn the rest. Do not lose control of your warriors. Just cut off the enemy's toes and leave them there. Am I understood?"
Grinning, Vedith nodded.
"I would hear from that scout," he said after a moment. "Of course you would."
Gaul saw that Gerab had caught Shalamassa, and both were now riding in the wake of the South Scout. He spat to get the taste of the smoke out of his mouth.
"Dyker's eyes, what a sorry mess. No one ever learns, do they? Walida, would the Balkando have been content if we had treated them as badly as they treated us? No, of course not. So how in their minds did they justify such abuse?"
"They thought they could get away with it."
Gaul nodded.
"Do you see the flaw in that thinking, warrior? It's not hard, war leader. Have you noticed that it's the ones who think themselves so very clever that are the stupidest of the lot?"
He tilted in his saddle and loosed a loud, gassy fart.
"Gods below, the spices they use round here have raised a typhoon in my bowels."
The scout from the north arrived, the sweat on her face and forearms coated in dust.
"War leader!"
Gaul unslung his own waterskin and tossed it to her.
"How many and how far away?"
She paused to drink down a few mouthfuls, and then said above the heavy blows of her horse's breath,
"Perhaps 2,000, half of them levies, lightly armored and ill-equipped, 2 leagues away, in column on a too narrow road."
"Baggage train?"
She smiled through all the grit.
"Not in the middle and not flanked, war leader. The rear guard's about 300, mixed infantry. Looks like the ones with the worst blisters on their feet."
"And they saw you?"
"No, war leader, I don't think so. Their mounted scouts clung close on the flat farmland to either side of the track. They know there's raids out in the countryside and don't want to get stung."
"Very good. Change mounts and get yourself ready to lead Vedith and his wing to them."
Her dark eyes flicked to Vedith in open appraisal.
"Something wrong?" Gaul asked.
"No, war leader."
"But he's young, isn't he?"
She shrugged.
"Dismissed," Gaul said.
The scout tossed the waterskin back and then rode off. Gaul and Vedith now awaited the riders from the south. Vedith twisted to ease his back and then said,
"War leader, who will lead the force against the southern jaw of this trap?"
"Shalamassa."
Seeing the young warrior's brows lift, Gaul said,
"She needs her chance to mend her reputation. Or do you question my generosity?"
"I would not think to do that."
"You should, Vedith. That's what the Malazans have taught us, if they've taught us anything. A smith's hammer in the hand, or a sword, it's all business, and each and every one of us is in it. The side with the most people using their brains is the side that wins."
"Unless they are betrayed."
Gaul grimaced.
"Even then, Vedith, the crows
give answer,"
Vedith finished. and both men made the gesture of the Black Wing, silently honouring Coltane's name, his deeds, and his resolute stand against the worst that humans could do. A moment later, Gaul swung his horse round to face the scout riding in from the south, and the two warriors pelting to catch up behind him.
Shit of the foolish dog! Look at those two! Are you done with me, war leader?
Yes, go collect your raids.
And he leaned out one more time to make wind.
Gods below.
Still stinging from the war leader's tirade, Shelamassa rode hard at the head of her wing. Shouts from behind her measured out the raid sergeants struggling to collect their warriors as the ground grew ever more uneven. Deep furrows scarred the stony hills, and many of those hills had been gouged out. The Balkando had been mining here, for what, Shelamassa had no idea. They skirted steep-sided pits half-filled with tepid water mottled with algae blooms, narrow edges thick with reeds and rushes. Bucket winches slumped above overgrown trenches, their wooden frames grey and bowing, and strangled in vines. Hummingbirds darted above the lush crimson flowers dangling from those vines, and everywhere iridescent six-winged insects spun and whirled. She hated this place. The cruel colours made her think of poisons. After all, on the Kundril Odhan, it was the brightest snakes and lizards that were the deadliest. She had seen a jet-black, purple-eyed spider as big as her damned foot only the day before. It had been eating a hare. Neke had woken to find the skin of one leg, hip to ankle, completely peeled away by huge amber ants. She hadn't felt a thing, and now she was raving with fever in the loot train. She'd heard that someone had smelled a flower only to have his nose rot off. No, they needed to be done with this, all of it. Marching with the bone hunters was all very well, but the adjunct wasn't Coltane, was she? She wasn't Bolt either, not even Diker. Shelamassa had heard about the goring the Marines had suffered during the invasion. Like a desert cat thrown into a pit of starving wolves, if the tales were accurate. It was no wonder they'd been squatting in the capital for so long. The adjunct had Mintz's luck, that she did, and Shelamassa wanted no part of it. They were coming up out of the mining works, and to the south the land levelled out in a floodplain, broken up by blockish stands of bamboo bordered by water-filled ditches and raised tracks. Beyond this ran another row of serried hills, these ones flat-topped and fortified by stone-walled redoubts. Between the fortifications, a Balkando army was forming up, but in obvious disorganization. They'd expected to be one of the trap's jaws, arriving upon a battle already engaged, the Kundril muzzle to muzzle with the main force. They'd been planning on driving into an exposed flank. For all that, she could see they'd be hard to dislodge from those hills, especially with the enfilading forts. Even worse, she was outnumbered by at least 2-1. Shelamassa slowed her horse and then reined in on the edge of the bamboo plantation. She waited for her officers to close on her. Jerab, who had been verbally flayed almost as fiercely as Shelamassa, was the first to arrive.
"Commander, we won't knock them off that, will we?"
"Damned puffed-up messenger boy."
"When did you last ride to battle?"
She saw him flinch.
"If you were my son," she said, "I would have dragged you out of the women's huts long ago. I've got no problem with you wearing whatever it is you wear under that armour. It's the fact that Gaul cast a soft eye on you, Jerab, and that's not served you well. We are at war, you simpering coodle ape."
She turned as her six sub-wing captains rode up.
"Hanab,"
she called to one, a veteran warrior whose bronze helm was a stylized crow's head.
"Tell me what you see."
"An old border is what I see," the man said. "But the forts got dismantled everywhere but on those tells there. So long as the army stays where they are, they're stuck like a knuckle under a rug. All we need to do is keep them put."
Shelamassa looked to another captain, a tall, hunch-shouldered man with a vulpine face.
"And how, Kastra, do we do that?"
The man slowly blinked.
"We scare them so badly the hills they're on start running brown."
"Draw up the horse archers," Shelamassa ordered. "Onto the slopes. Start bristling the fools. We'll spend the day harrying them and piling up wounded until those forts are nothing more than hospitals. Come the night, we send raids into their baggage camps and maybe a few to fire the forts since those roofs I see inside are thatched. She scanned her officers. Is anyone here satisfied with just pinning the idiots in place?
Gerab cleared his throat. The war leader wants the threat delayed long enough to stop being a threat, Commander.
Half the army up there are levies, said Hanab. Skirmishers, deploying them against light cavalry would be suicide. Yet, he added with a sneer, look at how they're arrayed, five deep in front of the precious heavy infantry.
To absorb our arrows, yes, Shelemasa said.
Castra snorted.
The heavies don't want to dirty their pretty armor.
Bloody those skirmishers enough and they'll break, Hanab predicted. Then we can chew and nip the heavies for as long as we like.
Shelemasa turned to regard Gerab.
You stay at my side. When we return to the war leader, you will be carrying the Balkando commander's head on your spear.
Gerab managed a sickly smile.
Look down there,
Hanab pointed. Sliming up from the ditch and onto the raised track was a yellow and black banded centipede, wide as a hand and as long as a sword. They watched it snake to the other side of the track and then vanish into the stand of bamboo. Shelemasa spat and then said,
Hood, take this hole and shit in it!
After a moment she added,
But only after we leave.
1,000 warriors at his back, and Vedith did not want to lose a single one of them. Memories of the garrison attack still dogged him. A triumphant victory, yes, but now he had but a handful of companions left with whom he'd shared it, every blistering moment, and even now, should he meet the eyes of one of those warriors, he would see in them the perfect reflection of his own faint disbelief, his own sense of guilt. The crows alone chose who lived and who fell. Prayers meant nothing. Deeds and vows, honor and dignity, not one weighed more than a mote of dust on fate's scales. He even had his doubts about courage. Friends had fallen, one moment in his life and the next out of it, reduced to what memories he could conjure, all the incidental moments that had held little meaning until now. Vedith didn't know what to make of it, but he now knew one thing. The warrior's life was in its essence a lonely one, and the loneliness only got worse as one came to realize that it was best to hold back, to never draw too close to a companion. Yes, he would still give his life to save any one of them, whether he knew that warrior's face or not, but he would also simply walk away should one fall. He would move on, and in his eyes the barest hint of lost worlds. 1,000 warriors behind him. He would send them into battle, and some would die, and he hated that knowledge. He railed against it. But for all that, he knew he would not hesitate. Among all warriors, the commander was the loneliest by far, and he could feel that isolation sickening around him, hard as armor, cold as iron. Gaul, Adjunct Tavare, Coltane of the Crow Clan, even that Balkando fool leading his or her unsuspecting column towards an afternoon of nightmarish horror.
This is what we share, and it tastes bitter as blood on the tongue.
He wondered if the Balkando king now regretted inviting this war. He wondered if the bastard even cared that his subjects were dying. Or was it just the wound of lost revenues from wasted farms, devoured livestock, and the stolen hoards of wealth that stung him now? And the next strangers to camp on his borders? Would he treat them any differently? Would his successor heed the lessons carved out here in bone and flesh? The chain of dogs had fallen at the foot of Arran. Pormqual's 10,000 danced on trees. Leoman's rebel army was destroyed at Yagatan. It was clear, it could not be clearer, that for all there was to learn, no one ever bothered. Each new fool and tyrant to rise up from the mob simply set about repeating the whole fiasco, convinced that they were different, better, smarter.
Until the earth drinks deep again.
He could see the scout riding back towards him. It was about to begin, and suddenly each breath filling his lungs tasted sweeter than the last, and all that his eyes fixed upon seemed to throb with life. He looked upon things and thought that he had never before seen such colours, such textures. The world was made anew on all sides. But had he come too late to it? Only moments left to savour this gift of glory? The day's end would answer that question. Vedith prepared to lead his first army into battle, and in that moment he hated war leader Gaul, who had forced this upon him. He did not want to command 1,000 warriors. He did not want the weight of their gazes, the crushing awareness of their faith in him. He wished he had the courage to flee, but he did not, for Gaul had chosen well. Parasols in their thousands, fan-wielding slaves in their tens of thousands, none of this could keep the sweat from the face of Chancellor Rava. He felt as if he was melting in the cauldron of history, one of his own making, alas, a realization that came to him again and again like a fresh heap of coals. He huddled shivering beneath sodden silks as the palanquin he was in tipped precipitously, the bearers struggling to descend this confounded goat track. Dust had seeped in to coat every surface, dulling all the ornate gilt edging and deadening the vibrant colours of the plush padding. Dust mingled with the taste of his own sweat in his mouth. He even pissed grit, and worse.
"Not there, you stupid woman!" he snapped.
The Drasilhani slave flinched back, ducking her head. There would be no stirring awake down below, not today. He understood her desperation to please, and this knowledge made things all the more irritating. Whatever happened to proper, old-fashioned affection? But no, he'd done away with that long ago, as soon as he realized that, as much as he wanted it, he wasn't prepared to repay it with all that was expected in such an arrangement. Things such as loyalty, consideration, generosity. Those vile details that comprised the pathetic stupidity called reciprocity. He so disliked the notion of expectations, not the ones he held of others doing as they were supposed to do, but the expectations those others shackled upon Rava. Appalling, the nerve of some people. The greatest skill one could achieve lay in evading such traps. He was chancellor to the realm, ostensibly in service to the king and, heavens forbid, the queen. But overriding even this, he stood to serve the kingdom itself, its myriad sources of wealth, prosperity and so on, not to mention its smelly, crab-faced masses of ignorant humanity. Of course, he knew that in truth such notions held all the gravity and import of a toddler's birthday celebration, when all the effort going into it wouldn't even be remembered by the child so indulged, and what of the mess afterward? Never mind that Falash had made all the slaves drunk on suspiciously spiked punch, and that the chamber door's lock was jammed, and he, Chancellor of Bolkando, found himself trapped inside with no choice but to clear up the mess, if only to find somewhere to stand. And never mind that... Rava scowled. What had he been thinking about? Ah, yes, the paucity of sincerity that was, ultimately, at the very heart of political triumph. He had long ago discovered that brazen lies could be uttered with impunity because nothing would come of exposure, should that unlikely consequence ever occur. For even when such lies were indeed exposed, why, in a month or two, the finger-pointers would wander off, distracted by something or someone else worthy of their facile outrage. A mien of proper belligerence could weather virtually anything his accusers might throw at him. As with so many battles on a multitude of fields, it was all a matter of nerve. And, damn it, here and now, against this monstrous woman Krughava, it was Rava's nerve that was failing, not hers. Bested by a knuckle-browed barbarian. Outrageous. But what had he been thinking about? His gaze fell on the slave woman who still crouched at his feet, wiping her chin, eyes downcast. Yes, love. And that obnoxious creature, Falash, to have so contemptuously spurned his advances, well now, she would pay for that, for the rest of her life, if Rava had his way. And ultimately, he always did. Yes, he'd have her kneeling just the way this slave did, but the difference between the two would be the most delicious reward. Falash would not wear any visible shackles, after all. She would have enslaved herself. To him, to Rava. And she would find her only pleasure in servicing him, all his needs, every one of his desires. Now that was love. Groans of relief from outside, and the palanquin levelled out. Rava drew a handkerchief and mopped at his face, and then tugged on the bell cord. The contrivance lurched to a merciful halt.
"Open the damned door! Be quick!"
He tugged up his pantaloons and knotted the ties, and then half rose, pushing the Duras slave away. Outside, he saw pretty much what he had expected to see. They were down from the pass. Before them spread somewhat more level land, strips and stands of deciduous forest broken up by meadows used for pasture by the local savages. This region had served as a buffer between the miserable hill tribes and Balkando's civilized population, but the buffer was shrinking as the locals drifted away in both directions, into the cities or taking up banditry among the rock dwellers. There would come a time, Rava knew, when his kingdom would simply engulf the region, which meant establishing forts and border posts and maintaining garrisons and patrols to hold back the blue-skinned savages, all of which would devour yet more of the treasury. Well, Rava considered, there'd be income from cutting down all the trees, at least to begin with, and thereafter from whatever crops the soil could yield. Such thoughts comforted him, righted the world beneath his pinched feet. Wiping sweat from his face again, he cast about for signs of Conquista Avalt and his entourage of messengers, lackeys, and so-called advisers. The military was a miserable necessity, despite all its inherent pitfalls. Put a sword in a person's hands, and a few thousand others at their backs, and sooner or later the tip of that sword was going to lift to prick the necks of people like Rava. The Chancellor scowled, reminding himself to keep Avalt tightly bound to his belt, by way of that tangled skein of mutually rewarding interests he worked so hard to maintain. Surrounding him, the column of the Balkando Guard was spilling out, shaking loose over the swards to either side of the track. Oxen lowed, straining to reach the lush grasses, and from somewhere in the seething mob pigs were squealing. The air stank of human sweat and beastly dung and piss. This was worse than a Duras trader camp. After a moment, Rava succeeded in picking out Avalt's pennon, 200 or so paces down the trail. He beckoned to one of his servants, pointing to the wavering standard.
"I wish to speak with the conquestor. Bring him to me."
The old man plunged into the crowd. This army was exhausted, desperate to camp right here, though the day was barely two-thirds done. And as far as the Chancellor could tell, Avalt had halted the entire column. Rava craned, but he could not even see the perished legions. Somewhere far ahead, marching brainless as millstones. They should have ambushed these fools after all. What army could fight after such a pace? In full armor, barring shields, too, if that report held any truth. Ridiculous. It was some time before he saw commotion in the crowd on the track, figures hastily shifting to either side. Moments later, Conquista Avalt appeared, his face set in an uncharacteristic scowl. The gaze he fixed upon Rava as he drew nearer was something of a shock. Even as the Chancellor opened his mouth to speak, Avalt stepped close and rasped,
"Do you think I exist only to scuttle at your beck and call, Chancellor? If you haven't noticed, my whole damned army here has fallen apart. I've had officers deserting by the 20 pricks of Balat. And now you want what? Another smug exchange of platitudes and reassurances?"
Rava's eyes narrowed.
"Careful, Conquestor. Be assured, when I summon you, it is with good reason. I require an update, for as you can see, my bearers were unable to maintain your vanguard's pace, and now you have halted the entire army, and I want to know why."
Avalt blinked, as if disbelieving.
"Didn't you just hear me, Rava? Half my legions can barely walk. Their boots fell apart under them. The under-rigging for their breastplates has sawn into their shoulders. The manufacturers didn't bother softening the leather. Bedrolls rot as soon as they get damp. Half the staples have gone foul and were out of salt. And if all of that is not enough, then I should add this. We are at least 5 leagues behind the parish, and as for the army we'd left here to greet them, one messenger remained, to inform me that the Kundril Burned Tears are, as of 3 days ago, within 7 leagues of the capital. Now," he added in a snarl,
How many other blithe assumptions we made weeks back are about to turn out fatally askew?
He pointed a gauntleted finger at the palanquin.
Climb back inside, Chancellor, and leave me to my business.
A business you appear to be failing at, Conquestor, snapped Rava.
You want my resignation? You have it. Take over by all means, Chancellor. I'll ride back up into the mountains and toss in with the hill bandits. At least they don't pretend the world is just how they want it to be.
Calm down, Conquestor. You are understandably overwrought. I have no wish to assume the burden of your responsibility. I am not a military man, after all. Thus, I do not accept your resignation. Repair this army, Avalt, and take as long doing so as is needed. If the army we left here has departed, clearly it is to meet the threat of the Khandril. Presumably the threat has by now been taken care of, and either way, we here are in no position to affect the outcome, are we?
I would imagine we've had enough of our affecting matters, don't you think, Chancellor?
Return to your command, Conquestor. We can speak again once safely ensconced in the palace, where I can correct your misapprehensions about who serves whom.
Avalt stared at him long enough to make plain his disrespect, and then turned to retrace his route. Rava watched him march back into the crowd, and then gestured for his servant, who had unwisely stood less than half a dozen paces away during the course of the Chancellor's conversation with Avalt.
Find us a place to camp. Raise the tent, the smaller one. Tonight I will maintain the minimum number of providers, no more than 20. And find me some new women from the train. And no Daras. I'm done with their haphazard attentions. Go quickly, and get me some wine.
Head bobbing, the servant scurried off. Rava looked round until he found one of his assassins. The man was staring directly at him. The Chancellor flicked his eyes in the direction of the servant. The assassin nodded.
See what you have done, Conquestor? You have killed the poor old man. And I shall send you his salted head, so that we clearly understand one another.
Shield Anvil Tanakalian stepped into the tent and drew off his gloves.
I just took a look for myself, mortal sword. They are indeed done. I doubt they will even manage a march tomorrow, much less a fight any time in the next week or two.
Krughava was intent on oiling her sword and did not look up from where she sat on the camp cot.
That was easier than expected. There is water atop the chest. Help yourself.
Tanakalian stepped over to the salt-stained trunk.
I have more news. We captured a Balkando scout riding back through the dregs of the army that had been awaiting us. It would appear that War Leader Gaul has done precisely what we anticipated, sir. He is probably even now within sight of the kingdom's capital.
The woman grunted.
Do we wait for the Chancellor to catch up, then, to inform him of the altered situation, or do we maintain our pace? As much as the Khandril war leader might wish to besiege the capital, he has but horse soldiers at his disposal. One must assume that he will do nothing until we arrive, and that is at least 3 days from now.
Tanakalian drank deep from the clay jug, then set it back down on the pitted lid of the chest.
Do you expect a fight, mortal sword?
She grimaced.
Regardless of the unlikelihood that matters will deteriorate to that extreme, sir, we must anticipate every possibility. Even so,
and she rose, seeming to fill the confines of the tent,
we will add a half-night march. There are times when achieving the unexpected well serves. I would rather we intimidate the king into submission. The very notion of losing a single brother or sister to this meaningless conflict with the Balkando galls me. But we shall present to King Tarkalf a certain measure of short-tempered belligerence, as I am certain the war leader has already done.
Tanakalian considered her words, and then said,
Khandril warriors have no doubt fallen in this uninvited war, mortal sword. Sometimes respect must be earned the hard way, Shield Anvil.
I expect the Balkando have had little choice but to reassess their contempt for the burned tears.
She faced him, teeth bared.
Shield Anvil, they choke on it still, and we will ensure they continue to do so for a while longer. Tell me, have we availed ourselves of the supplies left behind by the fleeing army?
We have, mortal sword. Their haste is our gain. She sheathed her sword and strapped it on.
Such are the spoils of war, sir. Now let us make ourselves available to our sisters and brothers. They have done well, and we should remind them of the measure of respect we hold for them.
But Tanakalian hesitated. Mortal sword, are you any closer to your selection of a new destriant? Something flickered in her hard eyes before she turned to the tent flap.
Such matters will have to wait, Shield Anvil.
He followed her out into the well-ordered, quiet camp. Cook fires were lit in rows, spaced between companies. Tents covered the clearings in precise, measured-out regularity. The heady scent of brewing tea filled the air. As Tanakalian walked a step behind and to Krukhava's left, he gave thought to the suspicions assembling in his mind. The mortal sword was, perhaps, content to stand virtually alone. The triumvirate of the Grey Helm's high command was, structurally, both incomplete and unbalanced. After all, Tanakalian was a very young Shield Anvil, and none would see him as the mortal sword's equal. In essence, his responsibility was passive, whilst hers was front and foremost. She was both fist and gauntlet, and he could do naught but trail in her wake, as he was physically doing here now. How could this not please her? Let the legends born of this mythic quest find sharpest focus upon Krukhava. She could afford to be magnanimous to those she would permit to stand in her shadow. Standing tallest of them all, her face would be first to receive the sun's light, etching every detail of her heroic resolve. But remember the words of Shield Anvil Exas a century ago. Even the fiercest mask can crack in the heat. So I will watch you, mortal sword Krukhava, and yield you sole possession of this lofty dais. History waits for us, and all the creatures of our youth stand in our wake to witness what their sacrifice has won. And at that moment it is the Shield Anvil who must stride to the fore, alone in the harsh glare of the sun, feeling the raw flames and flinching not. I shall be judgment's crucible, and even Krukhava must step back and await my pronouncement. She was generous with her time and attention this evening, addressing every sister and brother as equals, but Tanakalian could see the cold deliberation in all this. He could see her knitting every strand of her own personal epic, could see those threads trailing out in her wake as she moved from one knot of soldiers to the next. It took 1,000 eyes to weave a hero, 1,000 tongues to fill out the songs of worth. It took, in short, the calculated gift of witnessing to work every detail of every scene upon this vast, sprawling tapestry that was the mortal sword Krukhava of the Perish Grey Helms. And he walked a step behind her, playing his part.
Because we are all creators of private hangings, depicting our own heroic existences. Alas, only the maddest among us weave in nothing but gold thread, while others among us, unafraid of truth, will work the fullest palette, the darker skeins, the shadows, the places where the bright light can never reach, where grow all the incondite things. It is tragic indeed how few we who are unafraid of truth.
In any crowd, he suspected, no matter how large, how teeming, if he looked hard enough, he would see naught but golden fires on all sides, so bright, so blazing in self-deception and wildest ego, until he alone stood with eyes burned blind, sockets gaping.
But will any of you hear my warning? I am the Shield Anvil. Once my kind were cursed to embrace all the lies with the truth, but I shall not be as the ones before me. I will take your pain, yes, each and every one of you, but in so doing, I will drag you into this crucible with me, until the fires scour your souls clean. And consider this one truth. Of iron, silver, bronze, and gold, it is the gold that melts first. She walked ahead of him, sharing laughter and jests, teasing and teased in the manner of all beloved commanders, and the legend took shape step by step. And he walked silent, smiling, so generous of regard, so seemingly at peace, so content to share the rewards of her indulgence. Some masks broke in the sun and the heat, but his mask was neither fierce nor hard. It could, in fact, take any shape he pleased, soft as clay, slick and clear as the finest of pressed oils. Some masks, indeed, broke, but his would not, for he understood the real meaning beneath that long-dead Shield Anvil's words. "It is not heat that breaks the mask. It is the face beneath it, when that mask no longer fits. Remember well this day, Tanakalian. You are witness to the manufacture of delusion, the shaping of a time of heroes. Generations to come will sing of these lies built here, and there will be such fire in their eyes that all doubt is banished. They will hold up the masks of the past with dramatic fervor, and then bewail their present fallen state. For this is the weapon of history when born of twisted roots. These are the lies that we are living, and they are all we will give to our children, to be passed down the generations, every catching edge of disbelief worn smooth as they move from hand to hand. In the lie, Krughava walks among her brothers and sisters, binding them with love to the fate awaiting them all. In the lie, this moment of history is pure, caged in the language of heroes. There is nothing to doubt here. We heroes, after all, know when to don our masks. We know when the eyes of the unborn are upon us. Show them the lies, all of you." And so Shield Anvil Tanakalian smiled, and all the cynicism behind that smile stayed hidden from his brothers and sisters. It was not yet time for him. Not yet, but soon. War Leader Gaul drew his black feather cloak about his shoulders and then strapped on his crow-beaked helm. He adjusted his overweighted tulwar onto the point of his left hip as he strode to his horse. Insects whirred in the crepuscular air like flecks of winged dust. Gaul hacked and spat out a lump of phlegm before swinging into the saddle. "Why does war always bring smoke?" The two young tier runners facing him exchanged looks of incomprehension. "And not just regular smoke, either," the war leader continued, kicking his mount forward to ride between the two warriors. "No, it's the foul kind, cloth, hair. Sits like tar on the tongue, eats into the back of your throat. It's a fall-damned mess, is what it is." Flanked now by the tier runners, Gaul rode up the track. "Yelk, you say there are Bargast among them?" The scout on his left nodded.
"Two, maybe three legions, war leader. They hold the left flank."
Gaul grunted.
"I've never fought Bargast before. There weren't many left in Seven Cities, and those ones were far to the north and east of our homelands, or so I recall. Do they seem formidable?"
"Undisciplined is what they seemed," said Yelk. "Squatter than I'd expected, and wearing armor that looks as if it's made of turtle shells. Their hair stands straight up, wedge-shaped, and with all the face paint they look half mad."
Gaul glanced over at the tier runner.
"Do you know why you two are accompanying me to this parley, and not any of my officers?"
Yelk nodded.
"We're expendable, war leader."
"As am I."
"There we do not agree with you."
"Glad to hear it. So, should they shit on the flag of peace, what will you and Ganap here do?"
"We shall offer our bodies between you and their weapons, war leader, and fight until you can win clear."
"Failing to save my life, what then?"
"We kill their commander."
"Arrows?"
"Knives."
"Good," said Gaul, well pleased. "The young are fast, and you two are faster than most, which is why you're tier runners. Perhaps," he added, "they will think you two my children, eh?"
The track lifted and then wound down over the ridge to converge with a broad cobbled road. At the junction, three squat, square granaries plumed columns of black smoke. A waste. The locals had lit their own harvest rather than yield it to the Kundril.
pernicious attitudes annoyed Gaul, as if war was an excuse for anything. He recalled a story he'd heard from a Malazan, Fist Keneb, he believed, about a company of royal guard in the city of Blor on Quantali, who, surrounded in a square, had used children as shields against the Emperor's archers. Dasem Ultor's face had darkened with disgust, and he'd had siege weapons brought in to fling nets instead of bolts, and once all the soldiers were tangled and brought down, the first sword had sent in troops to extricate the children from their clutches. Among all the enemies of the Empire during Dasem Ultor's command, those guards had been the only ones ever impaled and left to die slowly in terrible agony. Some things were inexcusable. Gaul would have skinned the bastards first. Destroying perfectly good food wasn't quite as atrocious, but the sentiment behind the gesture was little different from that of those Blorian guards, as far as he was concerned. Without the crimes that had launched this war, the Cundrill would have paid good gold for that grain. This was how things fell apart when stupidity stole the crown. War was the ultimate disintegration of civility, and, for that matter, simple logic. At the far end of the plain, perhaps a fifth of a league distant, the Balkando army was arrayed across a rumpled range of low hills. Commanding the centre, straddling the road, was a legion of perhaps 3,000 heavy infantry, their armour black but glinting with gold, matching the facing on their rectangular shields. A small forest of standards rose from the centre of this legion.
"Ganap, your eyes are said to be the sharpest among all tier runners. Tell me what you see on those standards."
The woman took a moment to dislodge the wad of rust leaf bulging one cheek, sent out a stream of brown juice, and then said,
"I see a crown."
Gaul nodded.
"So."
The Bargast were presented on the left flank, as Yelk had noted. The ranks were uneven, with some of the mercenaries sitting, helms doffed and shields down. The tall standards rising above their companies were all adorned with human skulls and braids of hair. Right of the centre legion, earthworks mottled the crest and slope of the hills, and pikes were visible jutting above the trenches. Probably regulars, Gaul surmised. Slippery discipline, ill-trained, but in numbers sufficient to fix any enemy they faced, long enough for the centre and left to wheel round after breaking whatever charge Gaul might throw at them. Behind all three elements and spilling out to the wings were archers and skirmishers.
"Yelk, tell me how you would engage what you see here."
"I wouldn't, war leader."
Gaul glanced over, his eyes brightening.
"Go on. Would you flap your tail in flight? Surrender? Cower in bulging breeches and sue for peace? Spill out endless concessions until the shackles close round the ankles of every living Cundrill?"
"I'd present our own wings and face them for most of the day, war leader."
"And then?"
"With dusk, we would retire from the field. Wait until the sun was fully down, and then peel out to either side and ride round the enemy army. We'd strike just before dawn, from behind, with flaming arrows and madness. We'd burn their baggage camp, scatter their archers, and then chew up the backsides of the legions. We'd attack in waves, with half a bell between them. By noon, we would be gone."
"Leaving them to crawl bloodied back to their city?"
"We would hit them again and again on that retreat."
"And use up all your arrows?"
"Yes, as if we had millions of them, war leader, an unending supply. And once we've chased them through the city gate, they would be ready to beg for peace."
"The Cundrill are Kul'tane's children indeed. Ha! Well done, Yelk. Now, let us meet this Balkando king and gauge well the chagrin in his eyes."
Six slaves brought out the weapons and armor. The gold filigree on the black iron scales of the breastplate gleamed like runnels of sunfire. The helm's matching bowl displayed writhing serpents with jaws stretched, while the elongated lobster tail was polished bright silver. The hinged cheek guards, when swung forward, would click and lock against the iron nasal septum. The Balkando royal crest adorned the vambrises, while the greaves were scaled black. The broad, straight-bladed, blunt-tipped sword rested in a lacquered scabbard of exquisite workmanship, belying the plain functionality of the weapon it embraced. Every item was positioned with care upon a thick magenta carpet rolled out on the road, the slaves kneeling and waiting on three of the four sides. Queen Abrastel walked up on the fourth side and stared down at the assemblage. After a moment she said,
"This is ridiculous. Give me the helm, sword belt, and those gauntlets. If I have to wear the rest, I won't even be able to move, much less fight. Besides," she added, with a glare to her cadre of pallid advisers, "it hardly seems likely they're planning betrayal. The presumed war leader and two pups against my bodyguard of 10. They'd have to be suicidal, and they've not shown such failings thus far, have they?"
Hethri, her third daughter, stepped forward and said,
"It is your life that matters, mother."
"Oh, eat my shit. If you could pull off the perfect disguise of a Cundril to get a knife in my back, there'd be four of them riding up to our parley, not three. Go play with your brother, and tell me nothing about what you get up to with him. I'd like to keep my food down for a change."
She held out her arms and slaves worked the gauntlets on. Another slave cinched the weapon belt around her solid, meaty hips, whilst a fourth one waited, cradling the helm in gloved hands. As Hethri retreated, after a few venomous darts at her mother, the queen turned to the Gilk war chief.
"You coming along to see if they make you a better offer, Specs?"
The Bargast grinned, revealed filed teeth.
"The Cundril probably hold more of your treasury than you do, Fireherr. But no, the Gilk are true to their word."
Abrastel grunted.
"I imagine the one you call Tool might piss in laughter at hearing that."
The Gilk's broad, flat face lost all traces of humour.
"If you were not a queen, woman, I'd have you hobbled for that."
She stepped up to the warrior and slapped him on one shell-armoured shoulder.
"Let's see those pointies again, Specs, while you walk beside me and tell me all about this hobbling thing. If it's as ugly as I suspect, I might adopt it for some of my daughters. Well, most of them, actually."
Snagging the helm from the slave, she set out down the road, her bodyguard scrabbling to catch up and then flank her and Specs.
"Your daughters need a whipping," the Gilk war chief said. "Those I have met, anyway."
"Even Spaltatha? You've been dimpling her thighs the last three nights straight. Some kind of record for her, by the way. Must be she likes your barbarian ways."
"Especially her, Fireherr. Willful, demanding. Any Bargast but a Gilk would have died of exhaustion by now."
He barked a laugh.
"I like you, and so I would never want to see you hobbled."
"But the wound that is named Tool is still raw, is it?"
He nodded.
"Disappointment is a cancer, queen."
"Tell me about it,"
she responded, thinking of her husband and a few other things besides.
"A woman hobbled has her feet chopped and can refuse no man or woman, or indeed camp dog."
"I see. Use that word in the same sentence as my name again, Specs, and I'll chop your cock off and feed it to my favorite corpse rat."
He grinned.
"See these teeth?
That's better."
The three Cundril were waiting on the road, still in their saddles, but as the Balkando contingent approached, the feather-cloaked warrior in the centre swung down and left his horse behind him as he stepped forward three paces. A moment later, his two companions did the same.
"Look at that,"
Abrastel observed under her breath.
"Show me a Balkando horse that just stands there once its reins are dropped."
"Horse warriors," said Specs. "They are closer to their horses than they are to their wives, husbands, and children. They are infuriating to fight against, queen. Why, I recall the Rivi—"
"Not now, Specs, and stay back among my soldiers. Watch, listen, say nothing."
The Gilk shrugged.
"As you like, Fireherr."
Despite herself, Abrastel was forced to admit that her first impression of War Leader Gaul of the Burned Tears left her uneasy. He had the sharp, avid eyes of a hunting bird. He was well into his sixth decade, she judged, but he had the physique of a blacksmith. The black tattoos of tears tracked down his gaunt cheeks, vanishing into an iron-shot beard. The vast crow-feather cape was too heavy to ride out behind him as he strode towards her, instead flaring to the sides until it seemed he was perpetually emerging from a cavern mouth. The scales of his black-stained hauberk were tear-shaped across his broad chest, elongating into layered feathers on his shoulders. His two bodyguards looked barely out of their teens, but they had the same predatory glint in their dark eyes. Abrastel had a sudden vision of taking the young men to her bed, and something delicious squirmed below her rounded belly. The young ones were best, not yet sunk into self-serving habits and whatnot, pliable to her domination, her measured techniques of training that some might call corruption. Well, her lovers never complained, did they? The queen blinked away the distraction and focused once more upon the war leader. She had learned something of the cult binding these Khandril, struck to awe and then worship upon witnessing an enemy on the field of battle, an extraordinary notion, she had trouble believing it. So foreign. In any case, whoever that commander was, who, in death, had found worshippers among his enemies, he must have possessed unusual virtues. One thing was undeniable. These savages had been fatally underestimated.
"War Leader Gaul," she said as the warrior halted two paces in front of her. "I am Abrastel, commander of the Evertine Legion and queen of the Balkando."
There was amusement in his eyes as they flicked to scan the heavily armored legion bodyguards arrayed behind her.
"And these are the soldiers you command, Highness? These tent pegs? When the Khandril whirlwind finds them, will they halt fast?"
"You are welcome to find out, war leader."
He grunted and then said,
"They will hold, I'm sure, even as the tent you call a kingdom is torn to shreds behind them."
He shrugged.
"We'll take care not to stumble upon them when we leave. No matter, it pleases me that the first title you gave yourself was that of commander. That you are also the queen had the flavor of an afterthought. By this, am I to assume that this parley is to be between commanders?"
"Not entirely," Abrastel replied.
"So what you have to say this afternoon binds the kingdom itself, including your husband, the king?"
"It does,"
he nodded.
"Good.
I will hear from you your list of grievances, war leader."
His bushy brows lifted.
"Why? Are we to badger each other with matters of interpretation? Your merchants practiced extortion on the Khandril and clearly had the backing of the military. We took their contempt for us and rammed it up their backsides. And now we are but a day from the walls of your capital. And here you are seeking to bar the way. Do we fight, or do you seek peace between us?"
Abrastel studied the man.
"The city behind me has walls and fortifications, war leader. Your horse warriors cannot hope to take it. What then is left to you? Why, to ravage the countryside until there is nothing left?"
"Easier to feed my warriors than for you to feed a city packed with tens of thousands of refugees."
"You would seek to starve us out?"
Gaul shrugged.
"Highness, Balkando has lost this war. If we were so inclined, we could simply take over, throw you and all of your bloodline into the nearest well and seal it up."
Abrastel smiled.
"Oh dear, now you show your hut-dwelling roots, war leader Gaul. Before I tell you of the overwhelming logistics of ruling a kingdom whose citizens consider conspiracy a religion, I need to avail you of some other details. Yes, your fleet warriors have given us a great deal of trouble, but we are far from defeated. My Evertine Legion, yes, it belongs to me, not to the king, not to the kingdom, has never been defeated. Indeed, it has never retreated a single step in battle. By all means, fling your braves against our iron wall. We will heap the dead two stories high around us. But I do not think you will have the chance, alas. Should we come to battle here, war leader, you will be annihilated. The Cundril-burned tears shall have ceased to exist, reduced to a few thousand slaves with quaint tattoos.
After a moment, Gaul hacked up phlegm, turned and spat. Then he wiped his mouth and said,
Highness, even as we stand here, your two flanking pincers are being filed down to stumps. Even should we lock jaws with your army, we'll hardly remain so locked until such time as any other relieving force you manage to cough up arrives.
He made a dismissive gesture with one scarred hand.
This posturing is pointless. How many days away are the Perish? They will take your Ivatine legion and melt it down for all the fancy gold on that armor.
As she made to speak, he held up his hand to forestall her.
I have yet to mention the worst you will face, the Bone Hunters. Among my people, arguments and opinions are unending as to who are the greatest soldiers the world has ever known. Ah, I see in your face that you think we strut about as one of those two, but we do not. No, we speak of the Wiccans of Kul'tane versus the Marines of the Malazan Empire.
His teeth appeared in a hard smile.
Lucky for you that there are no longer any Wiccans among the Bone Hunters, but alas, there are plenty of Marines.
A long moment of silence followed his words. Eventually, Abrastal sighed.
What are your demands?
We already have enough loot, Highness, so now we're prepared to sell it back to you. For food, water, livestock, and feed. But for the cost of my warriors killed or maimed in this war, we will pay no more than a third of the true value of those supplies. Once these arrangements are completed to our satisfaction, and once we are reunited with the Perish Grey Helms, we shall leave your kingdom. Forever.
That is it?
Gaul made a face.
We don't want your kingdom. We never did.
She knew she should feel offended by that, but the time for such indulgences would have to wait.
War leader, understand. The pernicious acts of the merchant houses which led to this war were in themselves abuses of the king's official policy.
We made certain those thieves were the first to die, Highness.
The ones you killed were but the tip of the poisoned knife.
She half turned and nodded to one of her guards. This officer led four other soldiers out from the squad, these ones carrying between them a leather satchel large enough to hold a Cundril teepee. They set it down and untied the bound corners, and then pulled flat the edges. A half dozen bodies were revealed, although not much was left of them.
These are the principal agents, said Abrastal, believing themselves safely ensconced in the capital. As you can see, only their skins remain. Our punishers are skilled in such matters. Consider them evidence of our acknowledgement of the injustices set upon you. They are yours if you want them.
Gaul's raptor eyes fixed on her.
I am tempted, he said slowly, to renege on my avowed lack of interest in taking over your kingdom. If only out of compassion for your people, Highness.
We hold to justice, Abrastal snapped, in our own way. I am frankly surprised at your sensitivity, war leader. The stories I have heard about the habits of savages when it comes to inventing cruel tortures
do not apply to us,
Gaul cut in, his voice hard as iron. After a moment, he seemed to suddenly relax.
Unless we happen to get very angry. In any case, you misunderstood me, Highness. That your kingdom is home to citizens of any stripe who know no self-constraint. No, even worse, that they would treat with foreigners unmindful of the fact that they stand as representatives of their own people and their kingdom, speaks to me of your self-hatred.
Self-hatred? I see. And if you were the king of Balkando, war leader, what would you do?
I would make lying the greatest crime of all.
Interesting notion. Unfortunately, usually the biggest liars of all are the people at the top. It's how they stay there, after all.
Ah, then I am not to believe a word you say?
You can believe me, for I can think of no lies that would win me anything.
Because my sword hovers over your throat.
Precisely. But the lies I was speaking of are the ones the elite use to maintain the necessary distinctions, if you see my point.
I do. And now he regarded her with keen interest. Highness, this has proved most interesting. But I must ask you one other thing. Why are you here and not your husband, the king?
The role of my Evertine Legion is to be arbiter of control within the kingdom and its own populace, as much as to confront external threats.
He nodded. Thus, your presence here serves dual purpose.
And the message presented to our rivals in the palace is, and do not be offended by this, the more important of the two.
And then she smiled and added,
unless, of course, you were seeking actual conquest.
Your husband holds great faith in you, Highness.
He has no choice. He does, and with reason.
Do you accept our demands?
I do, war leader, with some modifications.
His eyes narrowed. Name them.
The water we provide you will be doubled, and it will be freely given. We shall also double the forage you require for your beasts, for we know far more about the wastelands than you do, and we have no wish to make you into liars when you say you will never return to Balkando.
She paused, cocked her head.
Beyond the wastelands you will find the dozen or so kingdoms of Kolanse. War leader, I imagine you will not heed my advice, but I will give it anyway. You will find nothing of worth there. You will, in fact, find something terrible beyond imagining.
Will you tell me more, Highness?
If you like.
Then may I request that you do not do so until such time as either the mortal sword Krukhava or the adjunct Tavare is present.
Those you have named, they are both women, yes?
They are.
Will you feel out of place, then?
I will, but not for the reasons you might think, Highness.
I shall then await this potent gathering with anticipation, war leader.
And for the first time, Gaul bowed to her. Queen Abrastal, it has been a pleasure.
I am sure you feel so, and I do not begrudge you that. Are we now at peace?
We are. She glanced down at the skins on the leather tarp.
And these?
Oh, said Gaul, we'll take them. My warriors will need to see them to ease their rage, and for some to soothe their grief over fallen kin.
As he bowed again and turned away, Abrastal called out,
War leader!
He faced her again, a question in his eyes. The queen hesitated and then said,
When you spoke of your people's opinions, of these marines of the Malazan Empire, was there truth to your words?
He straightened.
Highness, although the great Coltane of the Crow Clan had many Wiccans with him, he also possessed marines. Together they escorted 30,000 refugees across a third of a continent, and each step of the journey was war.
Have I misunderstood then, war leader? Did not Coltane fail? Did he not die? And everyone with him?
The warrior's eyes were suddenly old.
He did. They all died. The Wiccans, the Marines.
Then I do not...
They died, Highness, even as they delivered those 30,000 refugees to safety. They died... But they won.
When she had nothing more to say, Gaul nodded and resumed his march back to his horse. The two young bodyguards moved to edge past her to help with the defleshed and deboned merchants. Abrastel caught the eye of the boy and winked. If he had been a Balkando, his eyes would have widened in return. Instead, he grinned. That dark thing came alive in her once again. Spax was suddenly at her side, watching as Gaul swung himself onto his horse and then sat motionless, presumably waiting for his two charges and the legionaries.
"I well remember, Malazan Marines," he muttered.
"And?"
"Gaul spoke true. A more stubborn lot this world has never seen."
Abrastel thought of Calance.
"They will need it."
"Fireher, will you escort them to the border?"
"Who?"
"All of them. The Kundril, the Perish, the Bone Hunters."
"I wasn't even aware the Bone Hunters were entering our territory."
"Perhaps they won't now that the need is gone."
"The Evertine Legion shall accompany these Kundril and the Perish. It seems, however, that some form of meeting of at least two of the three commanders is planned, and Gaul seems to think it will be soon. I would like to speak with them. Accordingly, you and your Gilk will now attach to me, and if we have to march past the border, we shall."
Spax showed his filed teeth.
"You can make a request to the war leader, Queen."
"I think I've already been invited."
"Not that,"
he jerked with his chin.
"The pup."
She scowled. The Gilk war chief grunted a laugh.
"You told me to watch carefully, Fireher."
Abrastel swung about and began marching back to her legion.
"Rava is going to pay for all of this."
"He already has, I gather."
"Not enough. I'll keep shaking him till he's old and grey and shedding teeth and whiskers."
"Gaul is disgusted by your people."
"So am I, Spax."
He laughed again.
"Stop sounding so smug," she said. "Hundreds, maybe thousands of Balkando soldiers have died today. I had actually considered using your Gilk for one of the pincers. You would not be so pleased with yourself if I had."
"We would have just kept on marching, Fireher."
"Studded with arrows."
"Oh, we'd leave a trail of our own, yes. But we would have arrived when we were supposed to, ready to deliver vengeance."
She considered that and concluded he was not simply full of himself.
"We should have heeded what befell the Letha Empire. Dear Balkando, the world beyond is very large indeed, and the sooner we send it on its way again, the sooner we can get back to our orgy of sniping and backstabbing."
"You've a nostalgic look in your eye, Fireher."
"Stop seeing so much, Spax."
His third laugh made her want to punch her fist through the man's ugly face. Impatient, Gaul left his two-tier runners to deal with the gift of skins and rode back to the camp alone. A formidable woman, this queen. Thick, long hair, the hue of flames. Clever eyes, brown so deep as to be almost black. Stolid enough to give Krughava a tangle in the spit circle with some lucky man the prize.
"And I'd like to see that match. Why, they're both enough to make me uncertain whether I was in bed with a woman or a man."
The thought enlivened him, and he shifted in the saddle.
"Bolts, balls, never mind that, you old fool."
They would not be quit of Abrastel and her Evertine Legion any time soon, he suspected. All the way to the border, and perhaps even beyond. But he did not anticipate betrayal. The Kundril had done enough to keep the fools honest. Honest in that frightened, over-eager way that Gaul so appreciated. Sometimes war did what was needed, always easier and lucrative, dealing with a reeling foe, after all. He was well enough pleased with how the parley had played out, although some unease remained, like a yurt rat chewing on his toes.
"Calance, what do you know, adjunct? What is it you are not telling us? You're moaning like an old man shivering under furs, Gaul. The Kundril, the Perish Greyhelms, and the Bone Hunters. No army can hope to stand against the three of us combined."
Volcando is small. Queen Abrastal rules a tiny, insignificant realm. And the only empire she knows is the one the Marines shattered. No, we have nothing to fear. Still, it will be good to learn what the Queen knows.
A cadre of wing and sub-wing officers awaited him at the edge of the encampment. He scowled at them as he rode up.
Seems they want to keep their kingdom after all. Send out word. Hostilities are at an end. Recall all the raids.
What of the wings attacking the flanking armies?
One of the warriors asked.
Too late to do anything about that. But send runners in case they're still fighting. Order them to withdraw to the main camp, and no looting on the way.
War leader, said another warrior, your wife has arrived and awaits you in your tent.
Gaul grunted, kicking his horse onward. He found her sprawled on his cot, naked and heavy as only a pregnant woman could be. Eyeing her as he drew off his cape, he said,
Wife?
She glanced up with lidded eyes.
Husband, how goes the killing?
Over with for now.
Oh, how sad for you.
I should have drowned you in a river long ago.
You'd rather have my ghost haunting you than this all too solid flesh?
Would you have haunted me?
Not for long. I'd get bored.
Gaul began unstrapping his armor.
You still won't tell whose it is?
Does it matter?
So it could still be mine.
She blinked, and a sharper focus came to her regard.
Gaul in Shikalan, you are 56 years old. You've been crushing your balls on a horse's back for 4.5 decades. No Cundrill man your age can seed a woman.
He sighed.
That's the problem. Everyone knows that.
Are you humiliated, husband? I did not think that was possible.
Humiliation. Well, though he'd never wanted it, he'd done his share of humiliating this woman, who had been his wife for most of his life. He had been 15, she had been 10. In the old days, they would not lie together even when married until she'd had her first bleed. He remembered the women's celebration when that time finally arrived for his wife. They bundled the pale girl away for a night of secret truths, and what had been a frightened child at the beginning of that night came back to him the following dawn with a look of such knowing in her eyes that he was left uncertain, feeling foolish for no reason, and from that day onward, that he was 5 years older than her had ceased to be relevant. In fact, it seemed as if she was the elder between them, wiser, sure of herself, and stronger in every way. He had worshipped that truth in all the years they had been together. In fact, he realized with a sudden flush, he still did. Gaul stood, looking down at his wife, trying to think of the words he lacked to tell her this, and other things besides. In her eyes, as she studied him in turn, something... A shout from outside the tent. She looked away.
The war leader is summoned.
Just like that, the moment was gone, closed up tight. He turned away, stepped back outside. The scout, the woman he had sent with Vedith, stood before him, spattered in dried blood, dust, slick gore, stinking like a carcass. Gaul frowned.
So soon?
We crushed them, war leader, but Vedith is dead.
Did you take command?
I did.
He tried to recall her name, glancing away as she went on.
War leader, he was leading the first charge. We were arrayed perfectly. His horse stepped into a snake hole, went down. Vedis was thrown. He landed poorly, breaking his neck. We saw how his body flopped as he rolled, and we knew.
Gaul was nodding. Such things happened, yes. Unexpected, impossible to plan around. That hoof, those shadows on the uneven ground, the eyes of the horse, that hole, all converging into a single fatal moment. To think too much of such things could drive one mad, could tip one into an all-consuming rage, at the games of chance, the cruel, bitter games.
War leader,
the scout continued after a moment,
Vedith's command of the ambush was absolute. Every raid set about its task, though we all knew he had fallen. We did this for him, to honor him as we must. The enemy was broken.
1,400 dead Balkando, the rest weaponless and in flight across the countryside. We have 19 dead and 51 wounded.
His gaze returned to her.
Thank you, Rafala. The wing is now yours.
It shall be named Vedith.
He nodded.
See to your wounded.
Gaul stepped back inside the tent. He stood, not sure what to do next, where to go, not sure why he was here at all.
I heard, said his wife in a low tone. Vedith must have been a good warrior, a good commander.
He was young,
said Gaul, as though that made a difference, as though saying it made a difference, but it didn't.
Malak's cousin Tharat has a son named Vedith.
Not anymore.
He used to play with our kith Anar.
Yes,
Gaul said suddenly, eyes bright as he looked upon her.
That is right. How could I have forgotten?
Because that was 15 years ago, husband. Because Kith did not live past his 7th birthday. Because we agreed to bury our memories of him, our wondrous first son.
I said no such thing, and neither did you.
No, we didn't need to. An agreement? More like a blood vow.
She sighed.
Warriors die. Children die.
Stop it!
She sat up, groaning with the effort. Seeing the tears he could not wipe away, she reached out one hand.
Come here, husband.
But he could not move. His legs were rooted tree trunks beneath him. She said,
Something new comes squalling into the world every moment of every day, opening eyes that can barely see, and as they come, other things leave.
I gave him that command. I did it myself.
Such is a war leader's burden, husband.
He fought back a sob.
I feel so alone.
She was at his side, taking one of his hands.
That is the truth we all face, she said. I have had 7 children since then, and yes, most of them are yours. Do you ever wonder why I cannot give up? What it is that drives women to suffer this time and again? Listen well to this secret, Gaul. It is because to carry a child is to be not alone, and to lose a child is to be so wretchedly alone that no man can know the same, except perhaps the heart of a ruler, a leader of warriors, a war leader.
He found he could meet her eyes once again.
You remind me,
he said, voice rough. She understood.
And you, me, Gaul. We forget too easily and too often these days.
Yes.
He felt her calloused hand in his, and something of that loneliness crumbled away. Then he guided their hands down onto her rounded belly.
What awaits this one?
He wondered aloud.
That we cannot say, husband.
Tonight, he said, we shall call all our children together. We shall eat as a family. What do you think?
She laughed.
I can almost see their faces all around us. The looks so dumbfounded, so confused. What will they make of such a thing?
Gaul shrugged, a sudden looseness to his limbs, the tightness of his chest vanishing in a single breath.
We call them not for them, but for us. For you and me, Hanavat.
Tonight,
she said, nodding.
Vedith plays with our son once more. I can hear them shouting and laughing, and the sky is before them, and it does not end.
With genuine feeling, the first time in years, Gaul took his wife into his arms.